Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, welcome back to another episode of Textory. I'm Carolina, and this podcast is all about historical texts of all sorts. If you want to support the podcast, head to patreon.com/textory as usual. And now let's jump into this one. Okay, let me premise this by saying, what do you think of when you hear 16th century Italy? Because I think Renaissance, right? I think science, art, Michelangelo, universities, education, maybe some pretty architecture, beautiful cathedrals, rich silks, maybe some elegant music, in general, bustling cities, you know, all that. Now, what I don't think about is bodily fluids. And it turns out that there was a lot of that going around. Today, we are reading Galatio of Manners and Behaviors from 1558. It was basically one of the first, if not the first, books of this kind where you had basically a guide on how to behave, what not to do, how to not offend other people. I must admit, when I started reading it, I was expecting things like maybe let the people walk out the door before you walk in. And it was a lot more gritty. But before we get into that, we need to talk about the author, because what a guy. It took me so long to grasp what was going on in his biography because there were so many places and people. So Giovanni della Casa, who wrote this book, was born in Florence in 1503. So that was around like prime Florence with Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci living there. I think he still lived there. So Giovanni first studied law at the University of Bologna, which is the oldest continuously operating university in the world. And he also used to write poetry. He was writing essays. He was an intelligent guy, let me just say that. But his eventual career actually revolved around the church. He was friends with many an important person within the clergy, including Alessandro Farnese, who went on to become Pope Paul III. So Alessandro was like, Giovanni, listen, this life is excellent. The food is great. The people are fantastic. I have 4 children. The Sistine Chapel's frescoes are about to be done soon. And your friend, Pietro Bembo, has chosen this path before you and he's not complaining. So you should do it. You should join the church as like your career. So Giovanni was like, you know what? I'm gonna do it. And he slowly climbed the career ladder at the Vatican and later in Venice. He actually established the Venetian Inquisition, but his eyes were set on the cardinal title. He really badly wanted to become a cardinal. However, there were some things from his past that just did not look good, and they were making it look very unlikely that he will be a cardinal, because first off, people remembered the poetry that he wrote when he was younger, and his poetry was, let's just say that his most famous poem was about comparing women's private parts to an oven and his private parts to bread. And second of all, even if it weren't for the crazy poetry, Giovanni had some pretty questionable friends. So he was besties with Lorenzino de' Medici. And Lorenzino was a bit problematic because he kind of murdered his own cousin who ruled Florence. And his reasoning was like, no, you guys don't understand. I had to do it because my cousin was a tyrant to the people of Florence. And I mean, it is true that there were a lot of people that were in political exile from Florence because of their beef with the guy. But with Lorenzino ending the main branch of the Medici family this way, needless to say, it didn't go down too well. Lorenzino ran away from Florence and ended up becoming friends with Giovanni. Which Giovanni, man, half of the popes that ruled during your lifetime, they were from the Medici family. So this all seems a bit counterintuitive to me. Like, why would you become friends with a man who murdered your allies? Like, and unfortunately, that was the case. It was counterintuitive and counterproductive because Pope Paul III died and the next pope did not appoint Giovanni as cardinal. So Giovanni ended up feeling very defeated. He sort of gave up on the church and he moved to Venice. So years earlier, actually, Bishop of Sessa, whose Latin name was Galatio, he was like, Giovanni, it will be kind of cool, since you're such a good writer, to write a book on manners and how you should behave. And now, with Giovanni being in a sort of voluntarily retirement, like he was moving between his Venice townhouse and a house on the outskirts of the town, I think, he sat down and he wrote the book and he called it Galateo after the bishop who suggested that he wrote it. So the book is basically guidelines and tips for people, mostly men, unfortunately. So this is going to be a bit disappointing if you're hoping for rules for women about how to move in society and how to avoid being a prick, basically. And a lot of these are kind of gross, not going to lie. A lot of these are very gross. But also, it really does show you how different the society worked back then. Because if he had to write about such obvious things, it must have been a mess. It must have been so disgusting to be among these people, not gonna lie. I mean, you're gonna see what I'm talking about in a moment, because here we go. It is an ill-favored fashion that some men use openly to thrust their hands in what part of their body they list. Likewise, I like it as ill to see a gentleman settle himself to do the needs of nature in presence of men, and after he has done, to trust himself again before them. Neither would I have him, if I may give him counsel, when he comes from such an occupation, so much as wash his hands in the sight of honest company, for at the cause of his washing puts them in mind of some filthy matter that had been done apart. So, peeing. Woo! Peeing in public. Let's not do this. And he also actually advises against washing your hands after you've peed, not specifically to not wash your hands, but to not wash them in front of your friends or other people, because then they're gonna be like, he just peed. That's disgusting. Which I think I'd rather have someone wash their hands in front of me than me having to guess if they even did it. So there be some kind of men that in coughing or sneezing make such noise that they make a man deaf to hear them. Other some use in like things so little discretion that they spit in men's faces that stand about them. Besides these, there be some that in yawning bray and cry out like asses. He has beef with sneezing, which is kind of understandable. It is loud and it is a bit annoying, but also sometimes there is nothing you can do. I was sick recently and the amount of sneezes that left my body on the daily was uncontrollable. So the best I could do was sneeze in my elbow like the 2016 dab epidemic and just hope for the best, because honestly, it was too much. But he does mention A, making a lot of noise, B, spitting in other people's faces when you sneeze, and C, making loud noises while yawning. So the fact that he has to write about such things is honestly a bit worrying, because that means that you could be an elegant lady in 16th century Venice or Florence talking to a hot guy, and he would just freaking sneeze at you because that was the norm and no one knew better. This is so disgusting, honestly. It's like someone would just scratch their ass in front of you because they have not read this book. Like, this kind of ruins the romantic fantasy of Renaissance Italy, not gonna lie. And a man must leave to yon much, not only for the respect of the matter I have said already, as that it seems to proceed of a certain wariness that shows that he of men that yawns could better like to be elsewhere than there in that place, as wearied with the company, their talk and their doings. That is solid advice, like don't yawn in front of the people that you're trying to impress because they're gonna think you're very bored. Like I remember, I think I was sitting in a park and there was an old dude walking by and I was just so sleepy. So I just yawned with my mouth like wide open. And he was like, am I that boring? Like, I'm sorry, my guy. I was just trying to get some air, I guess. But I kind of get it. It's probably not very nice, especially when someone's talking to you. I had this one friend that yawned all the time as I was telling my stories. And I was like, okay, they either have a problem or I'm that boring. And when thou hast blown thy nose, use not to open thy handkerchief to glare upon thy snot. I'm gonna throw up. As if you hadst pearls and rubies fallen from thy brains. Oh God, how am I gonna get through this episode? But also, this is something that's mentioned a lot in works talking about this book, is how humorous it actually is. I mean, obviously all of this stuff is actual advice. It's not supposed to be satire, but because of the contents of the advice, it has to be humorous because otherwise it would be ridiculous. So this is a good example of the humor that Giovanni uses. When a man talks with one, it is no good manner to come so near that he must needs breathe in his face. For there be many that cannot abide to feel the air of another man's breath, albeit there come no ill savor from him. Yeah, I mean, in general, even if your breath does not stink, maybe do not stay too close to a person that you're not good friends with or involved with romantically, because it's kind of uncomfortable. Okay, clothes. He actually talks a lot about clothes, but he doesn't say what to wear, but more about wearing the right thing. I would have every man well apparelled, meet for his age and calling. For otherwise, they seem to have men in contempt that be better attired than themselves. Where other men make much of their beards and wear them long, thou shalt not do well to cut thine off or shave it. Thou must not then go against common custom in these things, but use them measurably, that thou mayst not be an odd man alone in a country that shall wear a long gown down to the foot, where other men wear them very short, little beneath the waist. Let your apparel, then, be very well made and fit for your body. This is very interesting advice because it's basically about respecting the customs of the society that you're visiting or staying in. So it says a lot about respecting social norms of the place that you visit rather than establishing your character and position through your clothing. It's more about be nice and be respectful. And if someone tells you to wear a long robe, wear a long robe. If someone tells you to wear a short robe and it doesn't bother you, wear a short robe. It ill becomes a man when he is in company to be sad, musing, and full of contemplation. And albeit it may be suffered perchance in them that have long beaten their brains in these mathematical studies, which are called, as I take it, the liberali artes, yet without doubt it may not be born in other men. So he's like, don't be sad in public unless you're a mathematician. In that case, you know, you're exempt from it, but anyone else, you can't be sad in public. And you can't be too consumed by your thoughts, because that's rude. For even these studious fellows, at such time, when they be so full of their muses, should be much wiser to get themselves alone. That is fair. If you're in a bad mood, or if you feel like you need to think a lot, just don't go. Don't go to that event or social situation, because you're gonna bring the mood down. And I'm not saying about people being depressed, because like obviously that's gonna be good to them to actually speak to other people. But if someone is in a feisty mood and they want to make it everyone's problem, just don't go. In speech, a man may fault many ways. And first in the matter itself that is in talk, which may not be vain or filthy. Honestly, reading poems and diaries and letters from the era, I mean, it was very rare for someone not to be vain or filthy or both at the same time.
Some crimes are never forgotten. Others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.
Again, a man must not move any question of matters that be too deep and too subtle, because it is hardly understood of the most. And a man must warily foresee that the matter be such, as none of the company may blush to hear it, or receive any shame by the tale. Neither must he talk of any filthy matter, albeit a man would take a pleasure to hear it, for it ill becomes an honest gentleman to seek to please, but in things that be honest. Most of all, my takeaway from this is do not make anyone uncomfortable with what you're saying, which I think is solid advice even nowadays, because the amount of times that someone was just genuinely comfortable saying the most unhinged stuff in my presence, and I was just like, why do you assume I'm okay with this? Like, obviously, I'm not gonna make it into a big deal because I don't feel like having an argument with you right now, but why would you assume I'm okay with you saying these things? Now, this is very interesting advice because I find it quite unusual for the era. Listen. And likewise, they that scoff at any man that is deformed, ill-shapen, lean, little, or a dwarf are much to be blamed for it. Or that make a jibing and jesting at such follies as another man speaks, or the words that escape him by chance, and withal have a sport and pleasure to make a man blush, all these spiteful behaviors and fashions worthily deserve to be hated, and make them that use them unworthy to bear the name of an honest gentleman. And moreover, it cannot be good to jest in matters of weight, and much less in matters of shame. This is actually such good advice even for modern day, because I feel like we're getting way too comfortable bullying people and just attacking people's looks. And, you know, if anything is out of the ordinary, if someone is, God forbid, disabled, people are gonna be so rude. And I'm just like, why? Since when is that okay? You know, anyone that has a visible body difference, anyone that is shorter or taller or leaner or fatter, they're gonna get picked on. And I'm just like, this is not the 90s, you know, teenage movies anymore. Why is everyone so comfortable with doing that? But obviously it's because of the internet. But it's interesting that even back then in the 16th century, his advice was just don't make people feel bad about themselves. Don't make fun of people. Don't make fun of their behaviors. Keep it to yourself if something's bothering you. And if you do that, if you do point out people's abnormalities or something that you just don't like or something that does not fit your idea of what normal is, you're not an honest gentleman. You don't deserve that name. Neither must a man, to make other men merry, speak foul and filthy words, nor make ill-favored gestures, distorting his countenance and disfiguring his body. For no man should, for other men's pleasures, dishonest and dishonor himself. It is an art for a juggler and jester to use. It does not become a gentleman to do so. I mean, half of my friends would be cancelled by this because we do love a jester friend. We do love people that make faces and pretend to be other people. I mean, to me, it adds so much to the conversation when someone is very lively in their portrayal of the situation. So sadly, Giovanni disagrees. He's like, don't do it because it does not suit you as a gentleman. And therefore, if any man be in a readiness to tell his tale, it is no good manner to interrupt him, nor to say that you do know it well. How do you deal with that? Like, I'm asking you personally, you the ones listening, when someone tells you a story that you've already heard two or three times, because every time that happens, I'm like, it will hurt me less to listen to that story than to tell them that I've heard it before. And honestly, to be fair, when it's someone like an older person that has memory issues or someone, usually they add details to this story that you have not heard about before. So it's kind of like hearing the story anew. So sometimes I'm just curious as to what this version of the story will bring this time. Likewise, it is an ill-favored condition to stop another man's tail in his mouth. And it spites him as much as if a man should take him by the sleeve and hold him back, even when he is ready to run his course. Yeah, just don't interrupt people if you can help it, because I know some people have issues with that. But if you can help it, and especially when I'm telling a story, I feel like I'm getting triggered so easily by this. That's something I need to work on, actually, because a lot of people obviously don't do it on purpose and they don't realize. But when I'm telling a good story, let's say in a restaurant, and I'm so close to like the best part that it really, you know, I have to set the mood. I have to like work the emotions up. And then the waiter comes over to ask if the food's okay. I'm like, girl, I'm working here. I'm hard at work at telling a good story and you just interrupted me. But obviously she's just doing her job. So I need to work on that. But it does spite me as much as if a man would take me by the sleeve and hold me back. I'm not gonna lie, Giovanni was onto something. And when another man is in a tale, it is no good manner for you, by telling the company some news and drawing their minds to other matters, to make them forsake him clean and leave him alone. And when a man tells his tale, you must give good ear unto him, that you may not say otherwhile, a what or how? Which is many a man's fashion to do. Okay, some more about clothes. A man must apparel himself according to the fashions that other men use. For the garments of the old world have lost their date. For men of this age and this season to wear. And it is such an ill-shapen sight to see a man clad with other men's clothes, that a man would ween there would be a fray between the doublet and the hose. Their clothes do sit upon them so untowardly. Okay, I think he's talking about when the clothing is not fitted well for you. I think that's what he's talking about. It shall be then necessary for gentlemen and men of good behavior to have a regard to this measure I speak of. In going, in standing, in sitting, in gesture, in port, in apparel, in talk, in silence, in rest, and in action. For a man must not apparel himself like a woman, that the attire may not be of one sort and the person of another, as I do see it in some that wear their heads and their beards curled with bodkins, bodkins are hairpins, and have their face and their necks and their hands so starched and painted that it were too much for a girl, nay, harlot, that makes a merchandise of it and sets herself to the sale. Wow, someone complaining about men dressing too well and wearing makeup and taking care of themselves. I have not heard this one before. You must smell neither of sweet nor of sour, for a gentleman would not savor nastily like a beggar. And then he says in Italian, okay, I'm gonna butcher this. Né del maschio venga odore di femmina o di meretrice, which is like a man should not smell like a woman or like a courtesan. I do not by this forbid, but you may very well use some sweet smells of sweet waters. So he has some particular scents that a man can use, but the rest, absolutely not. And then again about the clothes. Your apparel must be shaped according to the fashion of the time and your calling, for the causes I have showed you before. For we must not take upon us to alter customs at our will. Every man may apply those fashions that be in common use, ye most to his own advantage if he can. For if perchance your legs be very long, and men use but short garments, you may use a mean, not too long, not too short. And if your legs be too small, too great, or crooked, make not your hosen of too light and garish a color, that it may not call men to look and gore upon your deformity. Thou must wear no garment that shall be too light, or overmuch dough. Okay, this daubde, however the hell you pronounce it, is apparently an old word for doublets. So he's saying, do not wear doublets with guarding, so too much decoration. For a man of the clergy must not be attired like a soldier, nor a soldier go like a player. This is something they had a massive issue with back then, dressing above your station or dressing inaccurately to your social position, social standing, to where you came from and who you were. It was so crucial to those people to wear clothes that reflected your position in society. And if you were rich, obviously they weren't going to complain about you wearing clothes that are too modest. But when it went the other way, they absolutely hated when people looked good and they were not rich enough. So this is something that sumptuary laws usually dealt with. But apparently it was also a matter of good taste and manners and being reasonable. I would not have a gentleman to run in the street nor go too fast, for that is for lackeys and not for gentlemen to do. Besides that, it makes a man wary, sweaty and puff, which be very unsightly things for such men to do. I would not yet have a man go so soft and demurely as a maid or a wife. And when a man walks, it is no good sight to see a man shake his body too much, nor to hold his hands bare and empty, nor yet cast and fling his arms up and down, in such sort as a man would ween he were sowing the corn in the field, nor stare in a man's face as if he had spied a mare's nest. So even walking was considered something that could potentially be rude or annoy people if you walked the wrong way. I mean, autistic people are not gonna love all these rules, not gonna lie. I'm assuming it must have been a nightmare to be an autistic person in 16th century Italy, because this is a lot. You have to walk not fast, but then you can't be too slow. You can't be soft and demure because it's going to resemble your wife. And then you can't shake your body too much. But also if you hold your hands and they're just bare and empty, it's also going to draw people's attention. It's just a lot. And I can imagine these are supposed to teach men good manners, but when it came to women, there were this many rules and probably like three times more that they actually had to follow. It was not a matter of, oh, maybe if you read this book, you're going to behave better. It was from the very moment you came to this earth, we are going to give you this set of rules that you need to follow if you want to be respected in the society. And it may come to a time when you're gonna be very well raised and elegant and demure, and you're gonna meet people that sneeze at you and scratch their butts. So I think that the difference between men and women must have been staggering. So this book was actually published 2 years after Giovanni della Casa's death, which is kind of a shame because he never lived to see how successful it was. And it was massively successful. People were obsessed with it. It was selling like fresh bread. Even mere years later, they translated it into several languages and it just traveled across Europe. It made it to Shakespearean England. Everyone loved it. Apparently, even Queen Elizabeth made her ladies in waiting to read it as a sort of reference, but I'm not sure how true that is because, I mean, it mostly refers to men, but it was definitely a beloved book. And it was the first book of that kind that ever made that big of a success. It has sort of laid ground for future works of a similar kind. And we know that there were a lot of them because, I mean, even the Victorians loved their manners and they wouldn't have existed, all those books, if it weren't for this one. And some argue that the work was sort of political because a lot of republics in Italy at the time, they felt the need to accentuate how well-behaved and well-raised they are compared to, you know, various barbarians that were plaguing the land. I mean, barbarians in quotation marks, obviously, but I don't know. I'm not sure about this theory. I think it was more about they had an idea, the bishop and Giovanni, and, you know, no one has ever written anything of the kind. And I think it was mostly supposed to be entertainment. But the fact that it was so successful, A, it must have been very funny to read, and quite shocking because it's quite straight to the point, I would say. But also, I'm assuming to a lot of people it was actual useful tips, which is a bit terrifying to think about because I would not survive this. I mean, I even have trouble nowadays when someone spits on the ground because that's just, I don't want to look at that. Back then it was like 1,000 times worse. So even if they did have basic personal hygiene, that does not mean that they were not gross. Because I'm always talking about like, oh, there is this myth that people didn't wash themselves, etc. Yeah, maybe they've washed themselves, but they still scratched their butts. So this was a very manly episode. I feel like spitting now. I feel very manly. Let me know what you think, if any of the tips were surprising to you or if it all just sounded like common sense, but back then it was groundbreaking and people couldn't believe what they're reading. So yeah, I think that's it for this episode. I'll hear you in another one. Bye.
Some crimes are never forgotten, others are lost to history. Those are the ones we focus on in Crimes of the Centuries, a history meets true crime podcast revisiting murders, trials, and frauds that once dominated headlines. I'm Amber Hunt, your host and a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. If you like true crime that feels both cinematic and historical, find Crimes of the Centuries wherever you get your podcasts.